I'm Norma Everest. I'm a professor at Wartburg Theological Seminary in Dubuque, and it's really fine to be here. Yesterday we had an inner circle. We just kind of fit and filled the circle right around the fireplace, and today we have about twice that many, and we have a different group. We're the same and always new, and that probably characterizes the church. And that dynamic between the two is always a challenge to work with. So let me just say a couple of things about what happened yesterday and then move into our time together today, which will be really quite different. Yesterday we considered the adult in the educational ministry or the Christian learning community and had a good time, I think, sharing with one another the ways in which we learn. It sounds so simple, but we found a large diversity among us. The very fact that as adults, there are some ways that we learn that we may think are strange or odd. You know, I really don't like a lecture. I'd rather read a book. Or I really don't like to read a book. Is there something wrong with me? With the idea that we can claim who we are. One characteristic about the adult is that they can claim who they are and take ownership of that and build from there. And I think that's important in relationship to myself. So I know that I am a person created and loved by God, unique in my own ways to learn. But also in the guilt trips or the programmatic trips we lay on other people in our communities back home. Why don't you come to Paul's Bible study this morning? You should come, and the people dutifully come. My thesis being that we ought to begin with the people and program from there rather than beginning with program and advertising so people will come. Well, if the adult learner is someone capable of owning and choosing and being responsible and accountable for his or her own learning, that makes a difference about the whole concept of adulthood. Yesterday when we put up here on the board lots of concepts that we had of adults, and we got some pretty heavy words up there like responsible and all this kind of weighty stuff that adults are supposed to be. And there's something about that very word which means you're done being a student. And I think that's why some of our adults at seminary and all the people who are there are adults by some standard. They all have a driver's license. They're all old enough to die for their country. That makes them adult. but they feel strange sitting in desks again because that's not an adult thing to do, or getting homework assignments, all of that kind of business. To be a learner in our society is to be a child. And so we say you go to school so you can grow up and do something, be productive. And even today, even though we've gone through such a shift in the last 10 or 15 years, some people still kind of apologize for being yet adolescent or not quite done because I'm still in school. Now, the feminist movement has helped both women and men, I believe, in turning that around and saying one can go to school at any time and change vocations at any time. And it's fascinating to see the varieties of vocations and vocational changes among men and women in our society today. Part of a previous generation's definition of adulthood was what you do, and primarily for men, it was what you do in the world. Women don't work, they're merely at home, and all that kind of language. And so you had to stay that the rest of your life, otherwise you lost your identity. And I think that's still true to some extent, and certainly still true among pastors in some extent. I am a pastor. What happens if I'm not a pastor anymore? That kind of identity by vocation. So education is something you do until you get to be an adult. And when you are an adult, then you do stuff. You're productive. And as we said yesterday, adulthood was sort of viewed as a plateau and you try to drop off at the other end. And when in older adulthood one is retired or no longer, quotes, producing, i.e. making money, then the definition of adulthood even doesn't fit and people become non-persons in our society. Well, maybe then that means we ought to change some of these definitions of adulthood, if the definitions are what get us into trouble. And definitions of adult learner and definitions of what it means to learn and grow and be and all of those kinds of things. Gabriel Moran, in an interesting book, Education Toward Adulthood, and some of his other writings, makes important comment that although we have given good attention to education for work, what skills, what abilities, what knowledge we gain so that we can work, we have given little attention to the education that happens by our work. And so for today, I'd like for us to explore together, and I mean that literally, I'd like for us to explore together what it is that vocation teaches us. What I do all day has a profound effect on me. I continue to be shaped and formed. We're aware of our experience together here in Holden Village will shape and form us forever. The fact that we've been here will not be erased. It has an effect on me. Well, likewise, in perhaps not such dramatic ways, but perhaps in more permeating, long-term ways, what I do between now and next summer is shaping and forming me. All of the jobs that I have had and done shape and form me. For a few minutes, I'd like you to just think on that for a while and allow yourself to turn back the memory for a bit in your own mind. Let your mind wander. I'll give you permission for your mind to wander. And if you don't ever come back, that's fine. If you're, you know, get so in tune with your own thoughts, fine, that's great. Let your mind wander back to some of the jobs, let's put it that way, some of the jobs you have had in your young adult life, some of you in your middle adult life. Some of us have a lot more adulthood to think about than the rest. What are some of the jobs? Just go back mentally to some of those places for a moment. Maybe there's strange, weird things that you've done. Just think about it. And then maybe you want to broaden that a bit. Because I've used the term vocation, which in Luther's term is all that I do in relationship to my neighbor. So we've had lots of segments of vocation, not all of which have been salaried or even job. Many in the volunteer sector, many relational. The time I have spent as an adult changing diapers has formed and shaped me. Time I have spent washing the panes on the window. The times I have spent that I have loved in working with that choir at church. And maybe you want to think about the various roles you've had. Some have been leadership roles. Some have been, it's just kind of nice to go and sit, kind of follower roles. Some have been challenging, right on the edge, I don't know if I can do this, right on the edge of one's ability. And others have been very mundane, downright boring. What's kind of coming into your head? I would love to be able to just kind of tune in, channel 7 over there, channel 9 over there, 1975, and we could all take a picture of what you're seeing. Memory's a marvelous thing. It could be painful, but a marvelous thing. Okay, as you're reviewing those memories, I'm going to ask another question. And that is, what did that particular vocation teach you? How did it shape and form you? What did you learn from that? And that can be kind of a one-level question, but it also can have deeper meanings to it. One can say, I learned how to change diapers. I can do that in my sleep. Or I learned how to iron shirts well. I remember years ago when in League at church, they had a thing called a slave auction. I don't know if you ever had that, where the Leaguers got auctioned off to people in the congregation to do work. And I got auctioned off to Mrs. Lutz, and she had me iron shirts. Well, my father had died when I was a child, and I had never ironed men's shirts. That's, you know how old I am now. It's the days when we iron shirts. And she taught me, the slave. She taught me how to iron shirts. And I was so proud, you know, with the back thing here, and I put that down and did it just right. In that job that day, one afternoon, I can still see the ironing board there. I learned how to iron shirts. Well, at one level, you know, what is it that our job teaches us? And maybe some skills are coming into your mind. But I'd ask you to think about it at a deeper level, too. What is it that those memories you're recalling bring to mind that your job taught you? A value system? An ethic? Rules to the game? Maybe various jobs have taught you, or have tried to teach you, they wanted you to learn, maybe you resisted learning, competitive value systems. Or different ethics. Maybe the job you had wanted to teach you an ethic that was different than the ethic which you already claimed for yourself. It was frustrating, problematic. Okay. Gabriel Moran talks about and asks the question, what does being on an assembly line teach an adult? On the way to Holden Village, we drove, and I drove some side roads in which there was a flag person standing there, you know, saying stop, one-way traffic, and then turn the thing around slow all day long. All summer long. I hope not all winter long. And if I go back those same roads, I may have forgotten that flag person in all the days I was here, but that person will still be turning the flag. And I, who am privileged to have a very fascinating job, cannot imagine what it would be like to hold a flag. What is that job teaching that person? How is that vocation shaping her? Okay. Has your mind been wandering somewhere, places? Well, I invite you now for us together to at least verbally tune in to Channel 7 or Channel 9, 1982 or 75 or 43, and to share at least verbally, since we can't do that technically, with each other's mental pictures, to share at least verbally some of these things. I am very, very curious. I meant that. I really want to... for us to explore this together. What are some of the things that your vocation has been teaching you?
Right.
3 to 5, I invite you to speak just a little loud if you can.
I work with 3 to 5 year olds.
Severely handicapped.
Okay.
And how do they teach you patience? Okay, good. No, but no, I know what you're saying. Nobody teaches you patience. One must learn it. Yeah. But yeah, I'm curious. Can you say more? And you could do it so much faster.
Yeah, and so you must be. You can't look at what they have accomplished in a day, a week, a month. You have to think of several months or years. You just have to kind of wait until they're ready. But when they get it, well.
Wow. That's neat. Mothers.
One summer when I was in high school, the only job I could find was, like, in the facility they call walking the beam, which means you get up at like 5:30 in the morning and get driven out in this truck to the bean field, and you can take your hoe and you walk up and down the long row and you pick out the milkweeds, and that's basically all you do until about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I would come home and all I would do is die. And already by about 6 o'clock that night, I was dreading having to get up the next day to go. I thought, I'm never going to be in a job where I dread having to go the next day when I come home, you know. All I did was work and then dread having to go the next day. And I thought, I have to make sure that I do something that I don't regret.
Like. So why were you doing it?
Money.
You look tired telling us about it.
Dread work. I think that certainly characterizes a number of workers. Dubuque Pack, millions of workers who in some ways either come to terms with that and compensate in their life in some other way, or slowly die in some. Others of you?
I had the same similar situation experience, not out in the field. When I was growing up, my father made sure that my two brothers and myself worked during the summer, you know, at something, basically. I think his goal was to instill in us a desire to stay in college.
Can it work?
And I remember spending 2 summers at a bed factory. It was a terribly dirty place to work because they have to keep all the aluminum or the steel has to be in oil. So you're always eating oil all over. So you go in a white t-shirt and hands come back completely, you know, blacked out. And for 2 years I stood at one place hand driving rivets, putting 2 pieces together and hand pounding a rivet. Yeah, fantastic. Large left arm. But in the process, I met several of the workers who had been there 15, 20, 25 yeah. years, standing at the same drill press, doing the same number of things that they're supposed to do every day. If they finished early, they would just stand there, you know, until it was time to go home. And they'd get 2 weeks vacation, and what did they do for the 2 weeks? They stayed at home, watched television, drank beer, or painted the house or something on that line. But over and over again, and in the conversations that I had with my, thinking back now, I didn't realize then, but they were kind of quizzing me on, like, what was going on in the world? Like, what's it like out there? You know, because they've always just been at this one little, you know, factory all their lives, and that's where they were going to be all their lives. I'll never work in a bed factory.
I never knew bed factory was dirty, so I've learned something.
Well, these were the frames.
The frames,
and the
not the feathers.
But dull, people have learned or have become dulled, is what you're saying. The sense of a passivity of drinking beer, watching TV, even to the point of saying what's going on in the world, so they're not quite living in it. Some others of you. Yeah.
I found my job. That I found that I didn't like some of the things that people were doing because I didn't feel it was honest and giving the employer a fair day's work. And I found myself becoming very angry about this, and I finally had to say to myself, I cannot change that other person, so I have to change myself, right? I have to learn to accept them for what they are. And just continue to say to myself, don't let them get to my inner being, and just do the best that I felt I could do and not judge what the other person is doing.
Do you feel kind of alone in that?
Pardon?
Did you feel kind of alone in that?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Like, I'm the only one that's crazy enough to work this way when everybody else...
Yeah, when everybody else is busy trying to see what they could do to... What would I say? See what they could get by.
Rip off the company.
Yeah, rip off the company. And, of course, you know that along with this, you take some harassment from the people that weren't doing the job. You'd say, well... You're a company man or something like that.
Oh, yeah. So a negative work ethic, for lack of a better word, you must be part of management if
not
you're...
Really.
No, but I mean, they would think you must be part of management if you're on their side. Sort of the...
Tomorrow, we're going to talk about the whole concept of competition. And we could make a bridge from that right now, but that's tomorrow. Any of the rest of you have that? Yeah.
One of the most enjoyable things I think I've done was one of my first jobs was delivering newspapers. I live in a small town, and my brother and sister and I each had paper routes. And I suppose you'd say it's a kid's job, but still that it's something. It was a responsibility, something you had to do, but also I enjoyed it so much because I got to talk to people and got exercise. I had some fascinating people on my route. One guy always came to the door in his underwear. He came in his underwear. another lady always fed me pretzels. Well, because I think that job has been meaningful for me because I learned so much from it, and I learned how to relate to people.
Couple things on that. One is the gift of work and of being responsible, being seen as an adult when you yet have a kid's job, as you say. That transitional time is particularly formative. And that it was a good experience for you. And doing something physical and somewhat mundane, yet had interest to it with the people. And there are many folk for whom their work may be quite simple, but it is enriched because, well, our mailman is a marvelous man. I think he really enjoys it. And he knows the people, and it just, he has a flow to his day, a rhythm to his day that I envy. I haven't quite managed that yet very well, to have a rhythm to my work and to be content with his work. And he's learned that, which is, it's not quite patience, but it's a different kind of, it's a rhythm. Somebody over here had a hand a minute ago.
I was thinking about, you know, some of the words that we had put up yesterday about what an adult is. And I think for me once, it's kind of interesting because you were talking too about how the factory worker was saying, what is the world out there like? And I think when I was a college student, we tended to think, you know, now we're in a sheltered environment, but pretty soon, you know, we're going to be unleashed and have to face the world out there. And that was kind of risky. But I think that my different jobs helped to teach me confidence, you know, and feel more like an adult, especially when people would look to me for advice or respected my decisions. And I think that confidence made me feel like I could risk doing different jobs or more difficult jobs, and so they provided a challenge as well.
So just as the work dread worker doll, this kind of business we ran a while ago, kind of deadens, this kind of confidence challenges, opens up, and we were saying that yesterday too, to growing edges, to I cans. And Paul, your experience too, I'm guessing, came out with a more, hey, I can do this. A healthy sense of vocation.
Yeah.
I was thinking about, I think really one of the best things about, and I guess all of us grow up having job after job after, you know, some of them only last a few weeks, but it seems to be the best thing for exposing ourselves to other people. in different situations, because you learn, I think we grow up in our little houses with our little families, thinking everybody in the world is just like us. And everybody has, you know, for breakfast a sandwich, for lunch, and you know, everybody does things like we do, and our way is the right way. And but you get out in a job, and no matter whether it's your first job is delivering papers or whatever you do, or babysitting for the neighbors, you find out that the neighbors don't live exactly like you do.
Come to the door and they're
going. Your father doesn't come to the door. And I think that's one of the best things, even now, that work does for us, is it exposes us to many, many different people with different ideas, and it's broadening. And even if it's a factory job on an assembly line, it's broadening because of the different people you meet, and you hear their experiences. I've known lots of, my father didn't work in a factory, but he had a kind of a routine job, and he didn't find it terribly dull. He loved people, and there were all people around, and it was the people there, all doing somewhat of a mundane job, I think that built each other up. It was not dull for him to go to work every day, because all of his friends were there.
Yeah, lots of things from what you say. Vocatio, vocation, is a means of connection with one another. And you described it so beautifully, coming out of our private or family world. I mean, just getting up and going to work is going out into the world. And a sense of the university or college business you're saying a while ago, there's something about going out into the, quote, hard, cold world. But it's always going out into the world. I'm now able to cross the street without anybody holding my hand. Both parts of that are true. Next week we're dealing with, I don't know, some of you will be here or not, but dealing with living in a pluralistic world. Vocatio can be a way of making connections. I even watch us around here at Holden Village. Each day we get up and kind of figure out how we're going to intersect with one another, go out into our public sphere. And we don't stay in our rooms all day. It's a little picture of that. Now, the other thing you said, I think is really important, is for us to make the assumption that everyone who has a factory job is dull and dead, and everyone who has a, you know, other kind of job is alive, is not helpful. And I think we spend a lot of time in an unhealthy way trying to say, oh, you ought to have this job, you know, you're whatever. I'm perfectly happy in the job I have. The very fact that each of us is created and gifted uniquely isn't absolutely marvelous. Maybe that woman out there holding that slow stop sign is really enjoying it. I mean, she might be.
At $19 an hour, she probably is. Yeah.
For the reward. Okay. We're open. We have to put the piece up here.
Good suntan.
So to make assumptions like too quickly is not helpful. We are gifted, we are unique, just as we all learn differently, we all, you know, have different work patterns, and thank goodness, I mean, that's the way the world runs. But you've already pricked me now to move on to the next thing, and that is that I am convinced that in our society we have done some very unhealthy things with work, and maybe it's a good point to move into that. The very fact that even in highly technical jobs, one is not able to see the whole thing. So one sits at a computer manual all day and sees this one little piece of something going in and has no concept of the total. The loss of the craftsman or craftspeople kind of concept in our society, so that one has a sense of ownership with what one has made, or just has a sense of the whole. We very compartmentalized, so that maybe we're more part of the real world in college, where there was a broader aspect on things, than very compartmentalized, segmented type of work. It's very hard. Such kind of a view of vocation teaches me only to look at my own little piece, maybe even in more devastating ways in my own little family, because at least there are a few people in that family. And so then we are surprised if people cannot look at the broad picture and cannot care about Namibia, or, you know, cannot care about peace and arms issues. Another thing that I think I've found is important to understand is that I think many of our jobs in our free society have taught us that we are powerless. Last night when we were gathered in this room talking about Hiroshima and and all of that, there was points in our conversation of frustration. Like, what do I do when I go back home now? How do I help other people know that we have to make a difference and we can make a difference? After the film, the day after, last fall, I was watching a TV talk show and was absolutely amazed, not at the people's fear, but at the people's expression of powerlessness, the passivity. Sort of like, well, when's this going to happen? Somebody's probably going to tell me. The people in countries of this world that are not free must look at us in utter amazement. We have so much freedom, so much power. And yet many of our workers, many of our adults feel or have been taught, quotes, by their vocation, powerlessness, passivity. I can't make a difference. And it's real, the frustration that what can one person do? And so you have to say, I have to deal with myself. And we haven't even touched on the frustrations I hear from people of the difference of ethic of the company for which they're working. My eldest son is in majoring in economics and political science, and a year from now he'll be graduated, and who he works for will be very interesting. With an economics major, you could work for different kinds of agencies or governments or businesses. And I think he'll have some very crucial questions to ask himself. Because the company will ask him to use, or the government or the agency will ask him to use his skills for a certain end. His skills are not neutral or will not be neutral once he is employed by someone. Now, what kind of power will he have for choices and changes? How is it with you or with people you know, people whose lives touch yours? Are those frustrations there? Do you see that and do you hear that sense of, I can't do anything? You know, it's just too big. The company's too big. The problems are too big. Or do you sense that they do have a sense of power, a sense of ability to make a difference in their vocation? Or yours yourself? Yeah.
Now, this isn't even on a global level, but I look back at, you know, jobs I had and things that made me feel good about myself and build self-confidence. And who I'm mostly in touch with is homemakers, because that's what I am now. And I think because of being in the work world that I do have some self-confidence, and I come in contact with a lot of housewives and often, you know, have those mood swings myself where you are not out meeting the public, you know, where you are not getting a salary. And I think the self-worth of most housewives is a lot in doubt. And I think, you know, now we're kind of coming, you know, where we are building those kinds of people up, but a lot of the women, I think, who have always been housewives feel powerless or feel like they are less than, you know, career women or career men. And I see a real dilemma there about where they fit into that whole drudgery, dullness. And yet at other times they feel positive about their job. But
so
I don't know
why I write on this, because it never comes out looking that good anyway. But. So that money and the public nature of it has given jobs worth, and we realize that, you know, all the terms that homemaker.
We can say that we don't buy into that, yet, you know, commercials and everything, you know, are saying a totally different picture. And I think since the women's lib movement too, unless you are able to do both, a lot of times, you know, if you are not, you know, the super mom as well as the career person, that a lot of women feel like they're not living up to everything that they should be.
So we've got the superwoman business. Yeah. So maybe it's a matter of renaming. We can do that as Christians, huh? Of naming what is vocatio, what is vocation. And by naming it, we already take some power away from it passively, or it teaching us passively, and naming it and claiming what we want to learn from it. And I think maybe there's some things in our lives we can't change, but some we can. The very fact that you name, I am learning patience, and what I'm doing, I heard from you, even though you didn't say it, there's value in what you're doing, even though it may take years for one of those children to learn a skill. You're valuing them, and your work has been named valuable by you.
the freedom in homemaking. At least there's a lot of variety in the day, and you can see the whole of it, and a piece from beginning to end, and there's some continuity. So naming it valuable.
That's the name of the book, Unbecoming. We're always becoming, growing. Have a different energy location. Okay. I've been seeing one very large technical factory near us has learned that the people in their factory don't want to work with us, but they do it. That part of it, and it's made a lot of it.
Okay.
So seeing the whole, at least a segment is completed, not just one little piece, but they see that rather than the isolated. I don't think they're an isolated factor. I think this has been, they have studies now.
No, it has, yeah, really. And companies that are seeing that what one does in their volunteer time, some large companies are giving people time off to do civic community things. So this is, they're grabbing a sense of vocation that Luther would be surprised and applaud. You know, that what they do all day is not their total life. Some companies have made good headway with that.
Okay.
So naming tasks, all tasks, with worthwhile. And we're trying to erase the money business. We have measured, you know, by money, and all the business about equal pay for equal work, and now compensatory work, and all this business is on dollar sign. And we can name, and we can appreciate tasks of varieties of work. We can also share in the menial tasks. And it's marvelous that around here we are all equal in doing dishes at Holden Village.
That's a fairly recent translation.
Really?
Okay. It was only non-teaching staff that do that.
And now teaching staff do
it as well.
Why not? You know, all of us. So a kind of, and it doesn't take that much time, a sharing of that.
And don't you learn appreciation for what everybody else has done?
in a large group, everyone putting their chair up against the wall saves hours of one person doing it. So that kind of sharing, sharing of taking turns, but also, you know, doing it together. Very simple kind of thing, but can be useful.
And the modeling, like when you see, you know, one of the staff in there in the kitchen swinging their hands, washing dishes. I mean, that gives, to see someone you respect and admire doing the trivial, you know, gives that a grace, which is, well, I can do that too. You want to climb on the bandwagon. We can all do that.
So that is teaching you. We talk about vocation teaching us. Someone else fulfilling their vocation, the menial as well as the high and mighty, has effect on you. Roland Bainton, who died just this past year, marvelous historian, used to have us out to his home, his cabin, north of New Haven, and we, just such a fine storyteller, we wanted to sit at his feet, and instead he fixed the meal for us and sat at our feet. The lesson of hospitality that I continue to learn from that great man has shaped and formed me, because he knew what his vocation was, and part of it was in serving us as well. The call to servanthood is a profound one. I said a few minutes ago that one of the first tasks I shared with you was being a slave labor ironing. The call to being a slave, to being a servant, Philippians 2, Christ thought it not, but emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, is a profound one, which the world cannot understand. Luther, in his treatise on Christian liberty, talks about the free person, Christian person, is perfectly free, slave of no one. Slave of no one, even though the company would tell me I am their slave. I had better be responsible to them. Or they'll make sure I don't get any other job. I am slave of no one. And at the same time, Luther says, the Christian person is perfectly free, dutiful servant of all. And living in that paradox is powerful, but we need each other reminding us of that. I need to be reminded that I am not slave to someone who would want to make me his slave, would want to control me, would want to have power over me. And at the same time to know and to be reminded that I am invited, freely invited to servanthood. It's profoundly different than the way the world views things. And it's very difficult because we're not going to stay at Holden Village, most of us, and we're not going to go away and live in caves. We are going to live in the midst of the world to live that way. And each of us knows some people who are able to live with joy that way. I think our custodian at Wartburg, Sam, does that in a marvelous, marvelous way. He knows his task.
I'd like to interject.
Please.
So I think he must know himself very well and have a sense of self-esteem.
Okay.
That if you don't come with something in your cup, you don't have anything to give to anyone else. And so I think the question is, Lord, how do you maintain this positive self-esteem that allows you to have freedom of choice and to look at the menial task in a positive way and to give it to other people in that way?
How do you think?
Well, you know, the principle certainly helps fill up your cup. And I think by support from other people, from other Christian community of saints, is what can do.
Do you have to hear it every now and again?
Yeah, reassuring.
Personally, with your name on it?
Yeah.
My self-esteem can go down the drain really quick. Any of the rest of you that way?
No. I have, I'm a substitute teacher. I have one class that I teach myself every day, but I substitute in high school. And so much of this, the seeing the whole, is interesting. I absolutely love what I do because I really feel like seeing the high school, from my perspective, the other teachers teach a subject. This teacher teaches history and this one teaches math, and I feel like I get to teach the kids.
Yeah.
Because I don't, I'm not responsible for, you know, I mean, they can like me a lot easier because I don't give them a grade. But in substituting, and I substitute everything is at boys' PE, it's the only thing they won't let me do. But
I bet you can
really,
do that.
Yeah. Well,
go ahead.
No,
go ahead.
I do do you know, auto shop and everything else that I do, nothing else. But it's interesting to see and to listen to the kids talk about the different teachers when there's a sub there. And you get to go into all these different classrooms, so you see teaching as a broader perspective. And I think a lot of the teachers only see their one little thing that they do. You know, the plastic shop guy goes in and that's all he does all day, is work with the plastics in the shop. He doesn't see the English teachers doing things this way. And the self-esteem thing is so important because, you know, I know the faculty on a personal level, but then I hear the kids talking about faculty, and so I see them from a kid's point of view too. And whether you like what you do and feel good about yourself and how you treat others is why the kids have respect for teachers much more than, well, that guy really knows his material. You know, the ones that really intellectually know their material doesn't necessarily make them the better teacher. And it's just the relationship with people, how they treat other people, makes such a difference on how they're accepted in their vocation.
If vocatio is all that we do in relationship to our neighbor, which is somewhat different from a Calvinist view of vocation, what I do to give glory to God, both are true, but the emphasis here of Luther's was on what I do in relationship to my neighbor. Whether it's carrying papers or substitute teaching or whatever, that relationship to the neighbor, and sometimes it is really hard, as you tell us, it is really hard, honoring the difficulty and yet calling forth people forth again to that vocation. Terribly important. A couple other things I want to lose about what you said. If you use the word collegiality, and I want to use that because I want to just say how important it is for me to work on a faculty with other professors who do have a profound sense of collegiality. We suffer together, rejoice together. We're very, very different. But the fact that we respect each other in each other's disciplines and respect each other as theologians without trying to say, the students like me better than you, and I've got my little disciples here against your disciples. kind of stuff, and I have time for that. The collegiality allows me to be all that I can be. That kind of sense of community, of networking, I think our world, we long for that. We long for a sense of neighborhood or a sense of collegiality at work. And we'll maybe talk about that again tomorrow, too, with competition. Because I think collegiality and competition, well, talk about it tomorrow. But the self-esteem business, the calling people, well, one time I was with a group of parishioners. We said, what really do you want when you come together as the gathered people of God? One said, unconditional love. Because out there all week, I don't feel that. It is always conditional love. It's conditional respect. Conditional. That unconditional love and the naming and the calling forth that you are a person in whom the Spirit of God dwells and that you are a power-filled person to name each other and the people whose lives we touch filled, power-filled. And in strange ways, what God may work through us in our vocation. I say to our students as they go forth into positions in the parish, you know, it's really tempting to think, are you getting a good parish? Quotes. What is a good parish? Wherever you're going, go there as you're going to go. You're going to stay there the rest of your life. I hope you don't, but go there as though you're going to. And Podunk Center, whatever, minister there as though peace might spread from that town. I mean, that the gospel, you know, in all its power, might, the work you're doing there might change the world. We think of the 12-year-old girl who died, but whose making of peace doves is spreading across the world. Her vocation, while she was dying at 12, has potential of changing the world. Helping people know that and saying it to them and naming so that as we see each other in the congregation, you're not just the usher at the door or the head of the finance committee, you know, but seeing people holistically and equipping and renaming how they are being shaped and formed. So we are being transformed into Christ. So the formation that our vocation does on us might be transformed into kind of a self-esteem and power for a vocation that the world maybe doesn't understand. But that is servanthood and powerful servanthood. I like to put those two words together.
Yeah, I'm not following you. I don't understand your definition of vocation or what you're... Okay. I don't see where you're going or what you're doing here.
Okay. What do you see?
That's why I came. I want to know what your definition of vocation is.
Okay. I don't usually begin with definition. Because I don't think we learn a lot by learning a definition. We've been defining together and exploring together. I've been using, to summarize a bit though, and to tell you where I'm coming from, some basic points, and that is that adults continue to learn. We are not done when we're 21. And that we continue to be learners all our lives. Either, and I used this phrase yesterday, either we are learning new things or we, through reinforcement, continue to learn some things again and again for 42 years. One other principle that I believe in, I think we've been saying, is that as Christians we have power to name and to claim, maybe not to change everything, but to at least not just be formed, shaped, taught without claiming that. An adult learner is someone who is able to claim their own learning. And even though what we do all day shapes us powerfully, and we may not have a lot of choice about all that we do all day, I have to keep my job, some people will say, we can, particularly through help of the Christian community, help define and even decide how that is shaping us. And I think we need help in that because it does get lonely out there. And we may even need help, and this is pushing a little beyond from what we've just said here, we may even need help in then making some choices. Bill Deal, in some of his marvelous writings, talks about that. So that as a Christian community, we can even help make people make some important decisions, vocational decisions. Vocation, however, I'm using Luther's definition, which is all that I do in relation to my neighbor, what I'm doing in the volunteer sector as well as in the paid sector and in the relational sector of my life.
So vocation is everything you do?
It's the work of my life, yeah. Does that make sense, or is that different from what you how you've used the term?
Well, I just didn't know what to expect when I heard people talking about two different realms, and I just went, mm-hmm. Some were talking about volunteer work or work at home, and some were talking about careers. Mm-hmm. And I guess I always thought of it as a career.
Yeah.
And I never thought of the volunteer work I did as a vocation.
Well,
something I enjoyed
yeah.
doing.
And I when I use the word, the Latin word vocatio,
see, I didn't know what you meant.
Yeah, which is another way of saying vocation, but it broadens it from our English usage of it, which indeed often does mean, let's see, my vocation is I'm a technician at so-and-so. I think it's helpful to recover, and that's a Reformation concept, really, to recover that a bit and to free people up. Let me expound on that just a bit. Just as a while ago we were talking about homemakers and we talked about how the world names salaried work of more value than volunteer work and so on, I think in the last decade or so the role of changes we've been about has begun to free some men up for a volunteer sector of their life too. My dream is that all of us would be able to have the salaried and the volunteer sector and the menial and the more challenging. And that somehow we're not locked so terribly into this is the wage earner and this one is the volunteer with all of the false valuing that that brought about. Part of my ministry, that's another term we could have used today, part of my ministry has been salaried and part has been non-salaried. And I don't think there's a great deal of difference between them. What determines if it's ministry or it's not is if it's serving the person in Christ-like ways. But the world values it differently. For a while, I went to volunteer in a local public school which had no music program. It's another story why. But anyway, I was a volunteer, and as I was doing this for a while, some of the other teachers said, well, you're very good. You see, if I was a volunteer, I wasn't supposed to be good at it. The expectation there. So that more holistic. Does that help? Yeah. Okay, we can talk some more. Somebody else? Okay. Yeah.
For me, I think, thinking in terms of that, especially in thinking of terms of how we relate to each other as Christians, I felt Mary Schramm's book on gifts of grace was especially helpful in saying when you come into a group, instead of saying, what do you do, meaning what is your paid job, trying to find out who are you, not what do you do, but who are you. And that's, not easy to approach someone like that. But I think getting away from, a narrow sense of vocation, that's what we really need to be doing to discover what people's real gifts are and not just limited to what is your 9-to-5 salary self, what is your...
We can do some dreaming together in Christian communities too, and discerning of and discovery of gifts and helping people, really allowing them to say, what do you really like to do? Instead of, would you please teach second grade because we need a second grade teacher desperately. No, helping them discern that and build on gift building, discerning. It's a very Christ-like thing to do. And sometimes it has profound changes in their whole life, or it may just have a little change. Yeah, or you...
Well, and just reacting or responding a little bit to what this young woman was saying, too, I think back that many years ago I used to think vocation was something elite. Uh-huh. That was a calling from God, and if someone would say they were a typist, I knew they could. That wasn't a vocation, And so I think...
That was a job.
That was a job, or a trade, or that would, how could that be a vocation, But now, that was because I think at that time in the period in our church, we weren't teaching and emphasizing that the priesthood of all believers and that we are all called And I'm sure we still have a lot of hang-ups out of that notion, you know, that limit ourselves, that I limit myself or other people do. So I think you are getting away from that just as a way of responding here.
I didn't begin today, and we could have, on the ministry of the whole people of God, that concept we've been dealing a lot with, and we're all ministers, those concepts we've heard. I really believe in that. I think sometimes we shortchange it. I've heard someone say, well, it's hard enough going to work. Now I have to go to work and think it's a ministry. yeah. So I think we've got to go beyond just kind of glibly having a ministry of the whole people of God week. Yeah. We have to go beyond to really help see what that means and supporting one another in that. That's helpful, though, what you say. Indeed. We used to talk about church vocations. And then other people had something else. So indeed, we are using that term, I think, recovering a meaning for it. And we haven't talked much about relation, but my husband's arriving soon, and with one of our other sons. And the last 5 years of our marriage, a very important segment of his vocation has been fatherhood to our three sons, as they're now in their teenage years. And that takes a lot of time and energy and struggle. And naming that an important part of his vocation at this decade of his life and their lives, and honoring that and supporting him in that, is really important, just as it is for me, particularly in the diaper changing days, when I felt very lonely and cut off.
It also gives you a greater aspect of your vocation to support him.
Yeah.
And, educate
us, encourage him. Well, as I said, as I began in a kind of a different way, and I'd like us to end that way, unfinished, if you will, because we didn't turn on all the channels in all of your heads, but you did. I guess I'd like for us to go apart thinking more about that. I'll leave it an open-ended question. How does what we do all day, How does our vocatio shape and form us? No, I better say it a different way. How does what we do all day shape and form us? And how can we meet that with a Christian sense of vocatio? Maybe it's at that intersection. Maybe you've helped me discern that more clearly. Maybe it's at that intersection that the work of adult education can go on. It's kind of an exciting place to do work of adult education, isn't it? How does what I do all day shape and form me? What I hear on the news all day, for that matter, how does that shape and form me? Because my reading the newspapers is part of what I do all day. And how does my Christian vocatio, you know, come together with that? That's an important point of adult educational ministry.